This week's show with Marilyn Hazelwood is sponsored by Sassy Jack Stitchery and Avlia Folk Embroidery. In 2022, Sassy Jack Stitchery is celebrating 5 years as your needlework supplies home. Be sure to visit the Sassy Jack's website and get your kit for The Sun Always Shines at Sassy Jack's, a special design by Lindy Stitches to celebrate Sassy Jack's 5th anniversary. Also, check in regularly so you don't miss any of the monthly releases of new Sassafras sampler charts. As we await the opening of the new Sassy Jack store, visit sassyjackstitchery.com for all of your needlework needs and to sign up for several live classes and workshops that will be offered in the coming months. Also sponsoring this show is Avlia Folk Embroidery, and designer Krista West has a parade of new designs. Two to watch for are Ukrainian tulips and a project that will appear in Taproot magazine. It's a linen apron with embroidered pocket tops. Another new design available at avliaembroidery.com is Baltic Scroll. This is a terrific design for beginners that uses a geometric border inspired by a motif from a vintage Latvian needlework booklet. Yet another new design is Calliope's Meadow. It is inspired by a tiny border on a traditional bed curtain from the Greek islands and is made up of carnations alternating with flower bud sprays that create a beautiful chevron border effect. It's available as pattern or kit. Be sure to visit avliaembroidery.com often to keep up with the new designs. Thanks to Sassy Jack Stitchery and Avlia Folk Embroidery for sponsoring the show. And now on to our conversation with Marilyn Hazelwood. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week from Tasmania, Marilyn Hazelwood. Marilyn, welcome.
Thank you, Gary, and hi to Beth.
Oh, we are glad to hear our first guest from Tasmania, I believe.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Another one checked off the list. How about that?
Well, that's good. That's good. You certainly talk to some very interesting people from all around the world.
We try. We try to get around. Yep. All right.
Yep.
44 years of needlework, self-taught, and a non-perfectionist.
Yep.
That's a history right there. Yep.
Yep. I like to stress the non-perfectionist side. I like people to stitch to the best of their ability, but I don't want people to worry about it too much. I want people to enjoy their stitching and to get the rewards out of it. I don't know what happened in America as people learnt their needlework, but I have discovered as I've taught around the world that often the ladies who attended usually Catholic schools would be so hesitant because they have the history of being actually hit over the hands by the nuns for not doing their stitching perfectly. And it's actually taken some ladies years or decades to pick up a needle again. And I actually had that experience in the very, very first class I took when I was just over the age of 23. And I couldn't believe it. The lady was so nervous. She was shaking. You could see she was shaking. And at the end of the class, she just thanked me so much for not growling at her, not making her undo anything. And for encouraging her to just keep stitching. And so it was a very, very good lesson, very, very early in my needlework history, that everyone needs to be able to enjoy what they stitch. And unfortunately, we often look at the back too often. We just think, you know, we look at the back of the work needs to be neat, but we often look at the back, and people will worry about the back a lot. So that's why my philosophy has always been enjoy it, stitch it to the best of your ability.
Okay, I'm sitting here hanging my head in shame, but whatever. now the first thing.
I hope you didn't slap someone across the fingers.
No. No, I just worry about the back a lot. But that's my own little problem. I'm getting therapy for it, so it'll be okay.
Oh, good. well, the thing that really, you just need your back's neat, but with silk ribbon, the back, there is a lot of thick ribbon carried at the back, so your back isn't always as neat as what it might be with a finer thread. So therefore, you've just got to concentrate on making your work as neat as possible. And your stitch, you'll enjoy your stitching more if the back of your work is neat. You won't be pulling ends of threads through as you go to do a stitch or anything. Oh, Gary, how interesting.
Yeah, that problem. Well, the first thing that we've learned here is, Beth, the next time we're in a group, We're going to take a poll and see how many Catholic stitchers we have.
I'm gonna say right now, it just strikes me as so interesting because I know at least one member of my guild. Her stitching is perfect. It's just beautiful, and I know she's got a Catholic upbringing, and I know she had to unpick things. So she does beautiful work, but she can't just enjoy it. Sometimes it's got to be totally undone and redone until it's perfect before she's happy with it. And I'm looking at it and I'm like, I don't see the problem, but I guess for you, you need to redo it, but I'd leave it because no one's going to see it. I mean, if it bothers you, yes, but.
Because Marilyn, teaching all over the world, for you to have that, because, I start thinking how many people are no longer stitching just because of that fear, and that's troubling.
Exactly. And often at seminars or crafts, well, over internationally it was more trade shows and seminars. But in Australia I'd attend craft shows, and so people would come along and admire my work and all the other exhibitors, and oh, no, I couldn't do that, no. And I'd start talking to them, and often they'd just say, oh, no, I was slapped over the fingers when I was doing my embroidery. And it then gave people a real mental block to get through that stage. So if someone tells me that in a class, I know they have really pushed themselves and got over that niggling history event they've been through to be in a class and or to be stitching, the whole story of what we do. So, yeah.
I mean, this is, we've talked about this, Beth and I, many times, and we've done it with other guests. We've talked about this problem, this quest for perfection. And then, you're in a class and you see the instructor whose work is we would hope, very clean at best or at worst. And then there's always two or three people in the class whose stitching is immaculate. And so it can be intimidating and you feel like you'll never measure up. And especially if it's your first time, then, which you can't expect to have perfection the first time. So as a teacher, how do you help people pass that?
That's a very good question, Gary.
Thank you very much. Okay.
that is such an excellent question. It depends a little bit on the technique. So I stitch a broad range of techniques, lots of different counted thread. I do freestyle embroidery. In this day and age, I'm certainly not a gold worker. I'm not a thread painter, but I do lots of different styles and techniques. And of course the silk ribbon. What I try and do is encourage people to stitch to their ability. It really is something that, especially over the last probably 10 years, has become a bit more of an issue. So often at the beginning of the class, I will say, please don't look at your neighbour. Please don't look at your best friend. Accept what you do. I will come and help you and give you guidance, but it's still up to you what you do, because it's your piece of stitching. It's your piece of work, and I've designed it. I'm here sharing it with you, but please just make it your own. So I try and encourage people to relax at the beginning of the class, especially when I've been teaching internationally. My regular ladies that I see frequently, it's a little bit different. But for and even so, I will still say to them, you know, if you're happy with that, that's fine. I hate asking a student to undo something. And they know that, because people will unpick because they look at mine or they look at their neighbours. And they think theirs isn't to the standard of what we've been doing. Now, the student who's worried may have only been stitching 2 or 3 years or 6 months. So it's a case of just saying, this is what I've done, but please make it your own. And please, the more you relax, the more you will enjoy it, and the more you will learn. Because a lot of the issue in a class, especially when I'm teaching internationally, is students are a bit worried. They're worried whether I'm going to be the Catholic nun and tap them over their fingers or not. And so my key thing is trying to get people to relax in their class at the beginning of the class. And often I will say the one thing I don't like is people licking their threads. And the ladies and maybe gentlemen listening to me that have taken a class with me will say, oh, yes, there she goes again, don't lick your threads. But the reason I say that is to try, because there'll always be someone in the class that they'll twig and they'll giggle. And as soon as someone in the class giggles, the rest of the class giggle. And I say, look, if you really can't thread your needle without licking it, just do it while I'm down the other end of the room. You know, I try and make light of the situation that we're in at the beginning of the class. So that's how I go about it. But yeah. I also, in saying all of this, I respect and I understand, because one of my best friends is a real perfectionist, and I understand their nature. So that's why, to me, it's just important to say, stitch to the best of your ability. Stitch, yeah. All you need to do is enjoy it, and especially in this day and age, enjoy your stitching and stitch it to the best of your ability. And if you've never worked with silk ribbon and you want a challenge of being able to not copy what I've done, play with silk ribbon, because silk ribbon is just wonderful. It's so flexible, it's so forgiving, it's so creative. It just does its own thing, and you really have to let go when you work with silk ribbon.
Yeah.
You've just got to let the ribbon sort of do its own thing. I mean, you have to learn the medium and everything like that.
Right.
And if someone's still really uptight, I'll often say to them, you know, when you're stitching at home and you've got a glass of wine nearby, go and have a glass of wine. And some people in the class will look at me as if to say, I don't drink. And then I go on and say, I don't mean for you to drink a glass of wine if you don't normally. But what I want you to do is to relax.
Yeah.
So if you have a glass of wine, you might just relax that fraction, and then the shoulders go down, and then you enjoy your stitching a lot more.
That's funny, because I know people who do like free motion quilting. Some of them say they have to have a glass of wine so they can relax enough to let the machine flow, you know. But if not, they're just so tense, they can't get that free form going, which is what they're looking for when they're free motion quilting. And so that just strikes a chord with me, because I think sometimes we do get too tense with our stitching, And it's like, you know, this is supposed to be a hobby. It's not, we're not in competition with each other. It's supposed to be something we're enjoying, something, you know, that brings us joy. And you know, it's just interesting that we get so uptight about it.
Yeah, a good point. That's exactly right. A few years ago, I was in America teaching at a, I can't even remember which guild seminar, you know, there was a dinner or luncheon or something, and one of the ladies sitting at the table brought this subject up with me and said, oh, you know, what are your thoughts about this, we're getting concerned about people thinking their work has to be perfect. So therefore, are we turning people away from stitching and from the guilds? And I said, well, I might be the wrong person to ask because I'm not a perfectionist. And it turned out she held a position, you know, one of the major positions in the guild. I didn't know at the time. But it is something that is often discussed about just encouraging people to stitch to the best of their ability.
Yeah.
And if everything had to be perfect, I wouldn't have done what I've done. And I think my years in retail taught me that, because everybody that is a customer and the many students we had in the shops were so different. So once you've worked in retail, you've got to just accept that the customer is happy with what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's, you know, this whole issue, I'm a former teacher. Beth homeschooled her kids. You know, if you've done any teaching, particularly of children, you learn right away that every kid is different, and there's a whole range in a classroom of skill level. And your job as a teacher is to help each one of them feel like they make progress themselves in, you know, over the course of time or even over the course of a class, and not feel like they're always competing, but are within themselves getting somewhere, making some kind of progress. And that, I mean, it can be tricky at times, but, you know, the people who are struggling, if you don't help them find positive things, then you'll just lose them quickly.
Yes, that's right. And the other big challenge for someone really new is if they come in very new to needlework, is it is such a huge, diverse industry with a huge range of techniques.
Yes.
And that's often another thing that students, they find it fascinating. You know, they come to do one style of technique, and then they realize, especially with my local classes, they realize that there's all these other different techniques out there. And so often, if I know I've got a student coming that's never, ever stitched before, I'll say this is a huge, diverse industry that you may or may not be aware of. So try this technique. If it doesn't suit you, try something else. You know, mm-hmm. You know, sort of there's so much flexibility now. And of course, with the internet and everything, people can get to know and understand all sorts of different techniques. A lot of people just think it's like we call fancy work, you know, the older style embroidered tablecloths and doilies. But it's not, you know, we know it's not. We know it's huge.
And I think that what's interesting is there's so many, like in Australia especially, I see a lot of the slow stitching movement. It seems like it's very big there, where there's a lot of more freestyle embroidery than when I see here, at least in my area. It's much more formal. People want to do like either the counted stitch work, and so it's kind of fun to say, look, you know, you don't have to stitch exactly like me. You can branch out and point people to that too.
Yeah, and I think a little bit of that is Well, number one, we have a very strong UK, United Kingdom. We tend to say British, but it's broader than that, heritage. So a lot of us would have started with stitching trace linen, fancy work, the doilies, the tablecloths. And so straight away we've probably, for people in my age bracket, there's that and then the screen-printed tapestries on Penelope, which I know is quite unusual in the US. But that was basically all we had. Some people would do a bit of Hardanger maybe in the earlier days, but it's certainly our heritage really was around doing the fancy work. So my mother was left-handed, so my grandmother taught me to embroider, and it was on a doily. And I didn't like it. I just didn't like doing it. I don't know whether I even finished it. And unfortunately, I think it's been, dumped in one of my moves. but I didn't enjoy that at all. I was knitting and crocheting. But then when I found tapestry, that was fine. I could cope with tapestry. And then when I was about to open my shop in 1978, a lovely friend of my mum's introduced me to counter cross stitch, and boy, did I love counter cross stitch, and that just took off. So I think there is, and also the other thing about Australia is we do, because our shops have a wide range of techniques in them. So there is no specialty needlepoint shop in Australia. There's no specialty cross-stitch shop in Australia. They might specialise in cross-stitch, but they would also carry other inventory for various techniques. So our market sort of demands that the bricks and mortar retail stores carry a range of different techniques.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, I think that's really instructive. You went through two or three techniques before you found the one that connected with you, and that's where, I often think, and I've suggested this more than once. People say, "Oh, I've just lost interest. I just have no energy to do counted cross stitch." Well, try a different technique. You might find you like it, and then you've broadened your horizons. And now you do multiple techniques even today. Is that do you still have a favorite, or is it whatever gets the job done for you?
Depends a little bit. Just going back to the printed tablecloth scenario, I even now struggle to stitch someone else's design that's pre-printed. So I'd much rather just sit down and do my own thing rather than... So in my Encyclopedia of Wool book, I've got 178 flowers that I designed for that, and that was all freeform, and that was all in these basic, the 10, 15 basic embroidery stitches. So they were the same stitches as what would have been used on the tablecloth. But I just enjoy sort of doing my own thing. So that's also interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And that is probably a little bit rare. Some, I know most people would struggle with that initially, and they like, and when you're starting to have a pattern printed on the fabric is certainly a much better idea. And if I do a printed design, I'll often change it. So I've done some of Hazel Blomkamp's pieces, and Hazel knows, and I've changed them drastically, just, totally different colours, thread stitches, the whole thing. And so, I think there is a lot of flexibility out there. It's just a case of what works for people. And it's trying numerous things until you find what works for you.
Yeah. Was owning a shop good for you from a hobby perspective? Did it enhance it for you or burn you out a little bit?
Both.
Okay.
Retail is so demanding. This industry is so demanding. If you've got a local retail store and you physically go into the shop or you place an order, please, please give your retail owner a lot of respect and a lot of good vibes. It's a lot more involved now than what it was. I haven't owned a shop since 1990. And even up to then, the inventory, keeping stock of the inventory, and virtually everybody that comes through the door wants help and guidance. They want to discuss the project that they're doing, or they'd like you to help them pick colours and threads, and it's a very, very rewarding but very demanding style of retail to be in. And yes, in the heyday of my Launceston shop, I had 3 teachers working with me, maybe 4. We were holding classes in a whole range of subjects. So I was carrying patchwork fabric, maybe knitting. At one stage, I kept knitting wool. We didn't do classes in that. And then there was all the needlework, counter thread work, cross stitch, tapestry. And then when silk ribbon came into the industry, well, I started working with silk ribbon. So, and I wouldn't have achieved what I achieved without the support of those wonderful women that supported me and Gary Clark. Gary Clark was, I don't know whether you know of Gary Clark, but no. He's taught in the US. Gary's a very artistic creative person, and Gary used to dress the windows for my shop. One of his professions was a professional window dresser.
Mm.
And so
there's a set of skills, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So yes, look, yes, I think I might have rambled on a little bit for you, Gary. But
no, that's okay. But did you, by the time you closed the shop, had your enthusiasm for needlework dwindled a bit, or was it close the shop so I can get back to what I really want?
I actually sold. I had 3 shops at one stage.
Oh, jeez.
Now, Tasmania, it's about 2 to 3 hours drive between Hobart, which is the capital, which is at the bottom of the state, up to Launceston, which is the next major city. And then I had another shop 2 hours west of Launceston. So for a few months, I had 3 shops. My love and passion for needlework, that wasn't burnt out at that stage. Silk ribbon had come along, and I just loved silk ribbon. And this was in the late 80s, and I would design and put pieces on the shop wall to show students what they could learn. And visitors would come in to the shop when they were visiting family or just visiting Tasmania. Oh, I have to say vacation in Tasmania. I'll tell you a funny story about the word visiting in a minute. They would say, I've never seen anything like this. You ought to write a book. And then someone else would come in and they'd say, oh, wow, look at that silk ribbon. Oh, I haven't seen anything like that. You ought to write a book. And so that's what started the spark of writing the silk ribbon books.
Mm-hmm.
And I also had, in the background, there's always a lot of people supporting you and giving you ideas. I wouldn't have even been in the shop if it wasn't a friend who was 20 years older than me telling me repeatedly, nicely, that I had potential and I needed to open my own shop or business or do tertiary education, do university, college. And I didn't want to do university or college, so I decided to open this shop with my own savings. And then once I got going, the importers, so in Australia, our industry is sort of, you know, minuscule compared to the USA, but there are a couple of very good independent importers that own, that would say bring in Krynex Red, Rainbow Gallery, that style of specialised item. And I would always talk to them after they'd been to a trade show, oh, what's happening in America, what's doing, what's, you know, what's the latest thing. And then when I started doing Silk Ribbon and I had this idea of writing the books and self-publishing, they would say to me, oh, there's nothing like this in America. If you're going to do this, you've got to think about the American market. So I just ran with it. I was a person by myself. I had no pets. My parents were in good health. I had absolutely no commitments here in Australia to sort of hold me back. And I just, you know, decided, okay, I brought out my first book. It was accepted. And then I just worked really, really hard for all of the 90s. And it was at the end of that that I was getting so exhausted that I was just very, very concerned I'd never be able to design again, because by then I'd worked out that people can teach and they can follow a book, but there's not a lot of designers, and the designing is a real passion of mine. So I thought, no, I've got to do something, and my health was starting to be affected. So I went to my general practitioner doctor, and he said, no, you've got to really think about your lifestyle. And I decided there and then to just stop. So it was the retail didn't really wear me out. It was the traveling, the commitments with the international work.
Yeah, okay.
And also by then Silk Ribbon had really taken off. When I first started coming to the US, there was one or two South Africans, two or three Australians, maybe a couple of New Zealanders and a couple of Americans designing with Silk Ribbon. But by the time I left, well, it was just everywhere, and, you know, I'd had my copyright breached and all sorts of things like that. So it was just the right time to step back for a while.
Yeah.
But I still stitched. It's just part of me. I'll stitch whether I'm teaching or releasing my designs or not. It's just part of what I do.
Yeah, okay. What is it about Silk Ribbon?
It's the freedom and the flexibility of it. You achieve your stitching very quickly. You do need to learn to understand the medium, because it is so different to most of the other threads that we work with. So with Silk Ribbon, you've got a width that's soft. You might feel scared of it. A lot of people are very hesitant because it is so soft to feel, but it's just got so much flexibility and forgiveness. And it does take a bit to get used to it. Very few people can pick up Silk Ribbon and stitch it for the first time and sort of stitch with confidence. Because it does just take a little while to get used to working with. But I've had students, you know, they just say, yep, I can do this, I'm going to do it. It might not be as good as yours, or it might look different to yours, and I'd just say, yep, that's the whole idea. And it just has a lot of forgiveness. But it's a bit of a difficult medium because of that. It then makes it sort of creative, and I don't want to overuse the word creative, but that the word creative can put people off a little bit, but it's got its own creativity. So if you've only done counted needlepoint or counted thread work, and you're very, very used to following a graph and having your stitches basically exactly the same as the designer and the person next door to you in the class. The silk ribbon won't. Every student will be so different. So I've been very lucky. I was selected by EGA to come over to America a couple of times and teach my glasshouse fuchsia design. And that's with 13 millimeter silk ribbon. So that's really wide. But boy, does it make good flowers. And boy, is it just a stunning finished item in the way of the dimension that you get. And you get it so quickly. So it's, and everybody that stitches that design will stitch it so differently to me, because their flowers will sit and look differently and the leaves will be different. Because I virtually can't even repeat what I've stitched, and I don't try to. So it's a very, very forgiving medium, but it can also be very scary.
I love silk ribbon. I find it forgiving. You know, you do have to play with it a little bit. And I remember the first time I picked it up, because you're terrified. You've got, I was been using cotton, and all of a sudden I've got this quote unquote a very expensive thread. It's, if you get something that's variegated, I was like, I'm going to mess this up. And my friend said, no, you can't. You just need to relax and stitch with it. Once you start, it's just such beautiful. You get so many beautiful flowers or effects with it. It's so much fun.
Exactly. That's exactly right, Beth. It is. It is so much fun. And I say to students, you've just got to learn to work with the ribbon and understand the ribbon. And I always suggest they have a glass of wine when they're stitching the silk ribbon if they're really scared, because that's half the issue. And it is, I know it is a strange medium and a very different medium, but if you have that glass of wine, your shoulders will relax and you'll relax and you won't look at your neighbours or at my piece and think, oh, it's not exactly the same. You've sort of got to get this, it's exactly the same, out of your head. The other thing I'll say in classes is, if you do counter thread work, this is at the absolute opposite end of the scale to counter thread work. Because with counted thread work, you can repeat it so that it looks, it's exactly the same. You're counting your threads, no matter what technique you're doing with counted thread work. So with silk ribbon, it just gives, there's just a lot of freedom and flexibility there. So, and that's my way of doing it as well. Jenny Bradford, the other Australian who did a lot with silk ribbon in the early days, Jenny stitched very differently to me with silk ribbon. She was more uniform, more this is how you do it, this is how long you make the stitch, whereas I'm not like that. I just sort of stitch it and let the ribbon fluff and do what it does. So if you think of trying to do, say, a stump work fuchsia, the hours that could go into doing a stump work fuchsia is so different to, for me, 10 minutes. I would totally stitch and complete a basic fuchsia, not a gathered one, but a basic fuchsia easily in 10 minutes from woe to go. Mm. So it's quick. When you know and understand it, it's quick.
Yeah. In some of the material you sent us, you made the statement that isolation makes Australians, New Zealanders, Tasmanian people innovative. And we've talked to several people from Australia, and there is really a creative element there that I think we don't see necessarily anywhere else. And when you said isolation makes you innovative, I thought that was an interesting observation.
Yes, I'm asked this question a lot, especially when I was coming to the US in the 1990s, and Inspirations, the Inspirations magazine, was just coming out and was not probably quite as well known in those days as what it is now. Jane Nicholas was starting to teach in the USA, probably Alison Cole. And often in a class, especially if you've got a class of 3 or 4 days and there is a little bit of chatter, to me, oh, why are you Australians doing this? You know, how come you live so far away? And so it made me think about it a bit, and I'm sure it's something to do with our isolation. You know, when my ancestors started to arrive 200 years ago this year, they had to come by boat for 3 months from England, and they weren't convicts, they were free settlers. And to get a letter back home, it was another, so it was 3 months for the ship to go back to England and another 3 months for the return letter. So if they wrote to their parents, it was 6 months in between them sending the letter and a letter coming back. So you just can't go down to the local shop and buy or store and buy something. And I think that's all I can come up with, is the conclusion that our isolation sort of forced us into being sort of freer with our thinking and probably a bit more innovative. I was actually asked once at EGA to give a lecture on this. So I gave a lecture on how come us Australians sort of do this. And
what is wrong with you people?
I know. But New Zealand, oh, you think Australia's innovative? I just have so much respect for New Zealand. It's an amazing country. It's only 4 million people, and what they how they are innovative in New Zealand is just wonderful. And in their needlework, they're very, very creative. Really creative, interesting guild in America, in New Zealand.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the observations that I've put in my head just out of whole cloth is that where you're located in the world allows you to have equal access, if I can use that, I don't know if that's accurate or not, but to so many cultures. And so I think you see a lot of influence of different cultures that we don't necessarily get in the U.S. or that doesn't necessarily happen in the U.K.
That's a really interesting observation. That certainly happened in my lifetime with post-war immigration. So we had a lot of Greek and Italians come and some Middle European country people come to Tasmania and Australia and work after the Second World War. And we certainly, the governments are always wanting immigrants for working. I don't know how many of your viewers, your listeners know, but Australia is actually the big island, not where I live, the really big one people are familiar with, in land mass size is bigger than the USA, excluding Alaska. So Australia as a land mass is much bigger than the USA. We are just, you know, it sort of takes now, I think you could get into Asia for us, maybe 6 hours to get into Asia for a flight. Mm-hmm. But when I was doing all my traveling, it was basically 8 hours to get even into Asia. New Zealand's closer. It's about 2 hours flight away. So, yes, we're a big country. We've got interesting neighbours and we're a very, very small population. Australia as a country now is only about 28 million, I think, sitting around 28 million as a country. So that's why there's a lot of the government encourages immigration for for workers. And now we're getting very, very multicultural. We're a very multicultural society, which is really good. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No question. Yeah. Yeah. The let's talk about, we're going to run out of time, so we got to talk about your design work. I loved the fact that you, no computer, you design as you stitch, but your statement, I like the challenge of getting myself into a corner and coming out the other side.
Yep, that's it. That's exactly. I never, you know, when I fall off my perch and I'm no longer designing, if people came to my house, they'd probably think there would be sheets and sheets of paper of designs and concepts on it. No, I've got a tiny little design I'm wanting to do that I drew up on a sticky note. So that's, you know, what, 3 inches square or something. That's sitting right on the table waiting to be done. But nothing else. I might work from recently I've started sort of doing, I've been working a penguin, a puffin, and that was from a photo. And so I've started working a few things like that, but all of my needlepoint, counted needlepoint designs, as in the gardens and the various things I do for that, that's all totally out of my head. I've got to try and do this designing on the computer. And it was hopeless because I'd go to stitch it and I'd change it. So then I had stuff on the computer. I had to go back and change. So I only tried that once or twice and gave that up. I can't deal with that. And I don't, the other really funny thing about the way I design, well, it's not funny because it's a bit serious, is that I just design to a size. I never think of a Sudbury House box being 6x6 or 8x8. I never think of a product by Lee, you know, one of their bags, the size of the openings of a Lee bag or anything. I just simply stitch for what I want to do because we don't have those products easily available in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm going to be teaching at a seminar in the US, I don't want to be putting items into a box or a big bag because I've got to ship it over for display at the seminar the year before for taking classes, registration. So, you know, there's a lot involved why I tend to finish my projects into tote bags and cushions. I use, and I've got a wonderful friend who makes up all the tote bags for me, so that helps. I don't go near a sewing machine. Then sewing machines and I do not get on. it just comes straight out of my head. I might use a book for an idea. Recently, I bought a book on royal gardens in Europe. And so they will have the plan for the garden. And sometimes I work, that gives me inspiration, but I always change it. You know, if someone looked at my design and then went and looked at the garden, they think, oh, no, that's not right. So I often just need that bit of inspiration, but that's all. Just comes straight from head to heart as I stitch.
So then an inspiration, and then it's a constant evolution from that first stitch to the last one.
Yes and no. Sometimes I'll select a colour. Sometimes a colour will get me, I'll see something like I might see last spring there was a lovely tree that I walked past quite a lot that had really vivid florid greens and then red in it, in the leaves, the little stem of the leaves as they were opening out. So I've got those set aside for another project to do just in those colours.
Mm.
So it can be an inspiration of a colour mix. I might look at what I've designed recently and thought, oh, I haven't designed anything in blue. Oh, okay, let's get in and do something in blue. So it can be all sorts of reasons, but I'll pick a design or a stitch. That's the other thing I've done a little bit lately, is pick two or three stitches and play with them within the design. So they're repeated in different formats. Mm. So that it shows what, and one of them is a mosaic stitch, and there's a project that'll come up with ANG shortly. And I've just played with mosaic stitch in all different formats with different threads. So it can just depend on how I'm feeling and how I want to challenge myself. Mm-hmm. I virtually never unpick a design as I'm stitching it. Occasionally, now that I'm doing a bit more freeform work of seams and things, I've unpicked there a bit. But now that I've done that once, I've sort of got that technique and system sort of right in my head. So, yeah.
Your color palette is, there's a pleasantness to it. Do you tend to have a palette that you stick to, or does it just appear that way?
Oh, thank you, Gary. That's a lovely compliment. That's really interesting because I tend to think of.
I'm sorry I made you think about it. Oh, no.
Yeah, that's it. No. It's often, the fuchsia design, for instance, glasshouse fuchsias, that just came to me in 5 seconds. I mean, that was amazing. I just had that planned right down pat. I only had to select the threads for it. So sometimes that will happen. Another time, it might be, I want to stitch this flower. Oh, yes, I've got this in the garden. It's coming out. Oh, isn't that good? Now, how can I use that? You know, so it does vary. It does vary a lot as to how I'm inspired to create a design.
So do you, most of your designs, they look like they have one color palette. Do you find that's just what you like to offer?
Yes. Now, in my needlepoint designs, mm-hmm. With the glasshouse fuchsias, you really couldn't change that for the concept of all the soft grey tone background is representing an old glasshouse, and old glass is wobbly and wavy. And it's not clear like new glass. So if you've got a very old glass house in your botanical gardens or an old the garden of an old homestead, you go and look at it and all the glass is wavy. So you've got all these different changes of grey. So that's very standard. I'd never change my colour selection for that. Right. The Cyclamen project, that didn't work with changing its colorway, but it's the first of four. I'm going to do a series of four flowers, different flowers in that format. But then some of the others, like I've had a project on with EGA that's sunflower seeds, and there's four color options with that. And I actually restitched it once. I was feeling like my brain needed a rest. And I restitched it in all pinks, but I know that not a lot of people always like a lot of pinks. So, you know, it's sort of, this offering of four or more colourways, it would be very new to Australians for counter thread work, counter canvas work, counter needlepoint. It's very much what I consider an American American offer, which is really good because it actually allows broader flexibility for people to do the design.
So Australians tend to just do it in the colorway you first offer it then? I'm curious.
Oh, yep, they're actually probably more inclined to go away and do it in their stash.
Oh, okay.
You know, I've had students repeat some of my designs and they'll say, oh, I've got leftover threads from such and such, I'm going to do it in this. And I say, yep, go for it. And so it comes back a little bit to this innovative side and Yeah, so a lot of people might, I'm not saying all the time, but they are just as likely to use up some of their stash. Maybe they might need to go and buy a few threads, but they could totally change the colorway to what I designed. And I sold the design for the I gave it to her because she's my cousin. But I gave my cousin the sunflower seed design the other day, and when she saw the tote bag I was carrying with the sunflower seeds on, oh, she said, I'd love that. Oh, look at that, I can use up all my stash. And that's just very typically Australian. That's, yeah, you know, oh, yep, she'll be fine. She'll just do that.
Unlike us Americans who have to buy new stash all the time.
Oh, yeah, but you've got the access to it. You see, there would not be a shop in Australia that sold the full Rainbow Gallery range. So, and there'd be a lot of people in Australia that wouldn't even know what Rainbow Gallery was. So it's just a different style of culture and a different availability.
Right.
The design or two you have with silk ribbon and beads really stood out to me. That that seems like a quite a challenge to get beads in with silk ribbon and have it work. Is that as difficult as it looks, or is it pretty straightforward?
No, Gary, you need a glass of wine.
He might want a beer, but you know.
I want a beer. Yeah, true, Beth. No, you see, I play that, and I actually really struggle with all the technical side. So I love the designing, love the teaching. The bit in the middle, oh, jeepers, which I think a lot of designers often struggle with, but writing up the notes and getting the graphs organized and everything is a real challenge, and it takes hours and hours and hours. It nearly takes longer to get that done than it does to do the stitching. I play. Whenever I'm doing something, I consider I'm playing. So straight away, I've just got this thought in my head, oh, I'm going to play with this. Oh, I'll see how this goes. If it doesn't work, well, you know, I'll do something else. And so I've got a very relaxed approach to what I do because of the techniques I work in.
Mm-hmm.
Don't give me gold work. Don't give me stump work. You know, I've dabbled in those. Nah, I've got to think about that too much, and it's got to be, you know, all okay. So, you know, it's just what works for me, and I've just been very, very lucky. I've had masses of support over these 40-odd years from all around the world, and I have still got support and people interested in what I do. So, you know, I just consider I'm very lucky.
Have you had, is there a mentor that you've had through the years that has really helped you a lot, or have you just been pretty much your own, own person?
My mum, I'm the daughter of a very artistic, of an artistic mother and grandmother and great-grandmother. So there's a very strong art foundation on my mother's side and a crafty foundation on my father's side. My mother painted in various mediums. My grandmother painted, did pottery, did woodwork, was really very progressive for her era for a woman to be doing what she did. And she was one of five sisters, and all five sisters did handwork and craftwork and needlework. So I was just very lucky at a very young age to discover I had a natural ability with what I can do. I can't sing a note in tune. I can't spell. My spelling and grammar's not very good at times, but I can look at a book and interpret the instructions for the stitch in a flash. So when I opened my shop, I had no training at all. I'd worked in retail for 4 years, so I knew I could sell a product that I was passionate about. And people would come into the shop and they'd say to me, oh, I can't do such and such a stitch. Can you help me? I had never done the stitch before, and I'd go and get the old green DMC encyclopedia, and I'd just say, oh, look, I haven't done it for a while. I'll get the DMC encyclopedia, and I'll look it up, and I'll help you with it. And so I'd stand there. I could look at the diagram and tell them. I'd read it through. So it might say, you know, come up here at A and go down at B. And I could say, oh, this is how you do it. And off they'd go. They'd have no idea. I'd never done that before. So that, again, was an ability I learned at very early in the business. And when I was thinking about opening the shop, of course, I discussed it with my parents, and my dad said, well, it's your money. You can do what you want with it. Go and talk to the accountant. And the accountant happened to do needlework. He did what we call tapestry. And he said to me, oh, if you want to open a shoe shop, I'd say no. But the only department store that had any good handwork had just closed. So the city was sort of crying out for a craft needlework shop. And so I had to research it. I knew nothing. I knew about wholesaling and retailing because I'd been in, I'd worked in a retail store. But I had to learn it all as I went along. Artistically and in the shop, my mum was a huge support. She certainly would help me. In the early days, she'd come in and look after the shop while I, you know, went and did some jobs, and was a huge support all the way through. So my mum was really the one in the background that supported me. And then it was the staff. I've always been so lucky with the wonderful staff I've had that have worked with me through those shop days. And then once I started writing the books, it was the distributors. Well, boy, oh boy, did I have some fantastic distributors and people in the industry that just supported me. Yep, you know, give it a go. See how it's going to go. So I've just been very, very lucky.
What a fun family to come from. Wow.
Well, my dad in the early days, he'd just huff and puff. I don't understand anything about city life and you know, of his era, he would, you know, be and never, you know, I'd come back from a trip, and often in the mid 90s, I was doing a world trip, which meant I might call into New Zealand, then I'd go into America and attend trade shows and teach, and then go on to England to a trade show and teach.
Ooh.
And maybe teach in Asia as I came home. I'd be away 8 weeks, and I'd go to see my parents, and Dad would say, get down off your high horse, you know. Because I'd say, oh, you know, in America, I was teaching, if any of the ladies that owned stores in those days are listening to it, I used to teach them at Houston Quilt Market. Was the really, really big one where I'd have a group of 10 or 12 women around the table, and I'd be putting silk ribbon into their hand and getting them used to it. So, you know, it was just a fantastic experience. But I did it all by myself. People used to think, oh, you know, she's going overseas again. Oh, what fun. But it was really hard. Great, great fun, but hard work.
Yeah, that's draining. But so your dad would bring you back to earth when you got home.
Well, he'd bring me back to earth. But then in his latter years, I actually looked after him for his last 5 years of his life, only domestically. I certainly didn't need to do it any other way. But he would, you know, say, oh, you know, she's written books and she's, you know, travelled and taught in America or whatever. So he, in his latter years, he gave him some acknowledgement. But I knew and understood him. It never offended me. I understood him. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Marilyn, this is fun. There's about 100 more questions to ask, so that means you have to come back.
Thank you. That would be nice.
Yeah, we got to do another show. There's more.
Yeah.
There's nine books we got to explore. It's nine books, right?
Nine books on seven on silk ribbon and two on wool embroidery.
Yeah. Okay. See, we got to talk about those. There's so many other things. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Okay. We got to do another show soon. Yep.
Yep. Okay. Certainly my pleasure. Yeah. This has been wonderful, and I have so enjoyed the podcast that you bring to us. Unlike someone that let you know she was starting at the beginning, going through every one, I'm working backwards. I'm not starting at the beginning. I'm going backwards.
Oh, my. Okay.
It's really great. Thank you.
Well, glad you enjoy them. They're all there, so have fun.
Yeah.
I will. Yeah.
All right, Marilyn, thank you so much, and thanks to everyone for listening.
Thank you.
Bye,
baby.